Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Kirk Gray's on the line. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred. It's good to talk to you again.
Yeah. You know, our last episode, we kind of went off on an old military handbook, the Mail Handbook 217. And so we won't touch that one too much here, but it is often used in the development process, right? It's a tool. Somewhere along the development process, somebody says to the engineer, so how long will this thing last? That's not an uncommon question.
No.
Right? Now, you and I also...
And it's a question I'd like to know, too. I think everybody would like to know
those
questions.
We'd like to know that. Is this a good design? Is it going to be robust enough? Is it going to be durable enough, dependable? All those good things. Now, when you go to like physics of failure... It's talking about these like electromigration, which is a long-term degradation of the silicon traces, the metallization in a silicon device.
Right.
It's a wear-out mechanism. Electrolytic capacitors, right? The electrolytic coatings thin in certain areas, and eventually it breaks down. It's a wear-out mechanism.
It's a can. It's a sealed can with electrolyte in it
will
break down, chemically break down. Yes, it does. It's a consumed.
Brake pads wear out. Bearings
wear out.
Mm-hmm. Greases break down.
And you can measure those things.
Right. Now, in the design process, though, we also would agree. I'm dancing a little bit here because I don't want to get off on 217 or MTBF or anything else. But there's... You mentioned it in the last episode, and this is what made me think of this topic, is some failures occur because there's an error. Somebody makes a mistake in the design, and if you use it clockwise instead of counterclockwise, it's going to fracture just by design.
It was an overlooked many times.
Right, or we didn't understand how the customer would use it, and that's not a trivial thing, because until you give the product to customers, they don't know how they're going to use it, especially in a new or novel type thing. Mm-hmm. The way mm-hmm. customers use it or where they use it changes. So that's always mm-hmm. a moving target. But sometimes it's manufacturing. I mean, I've often said that any failure, problems with yield or manufacturing problems are always the design's fault, because we can only make it worse. We add variability to the product. We can strive to make it as good as the design could be, but we can only make it worse. There's design problems, there's manufacturing mm-hmm. problems, and then there's mm-hmm. those pesky customers that figure out new ways to break it. Right. Now,
find new ways to use it.
That's right.
And now, that results in a breakage, okay?
Right. Now, if you're setting out a new reliability program, right? Some of our listeners are developing new products or systems, or they're on a mm-hmm. factory line and they're looking at their equipment. How do these three stack up? What would you say is their weighting, design, manufacturing, or use, that we should pay attention to the most in a rank order in our design process or in our thinking about improving the reliability? Where should we focus?
Well, Fred, first of all, if you're a brand new company, I don't think there's anybody in the industry that's approaching a brand new, absolutely new product. So the first thing I would approach in any development process, if I was a company that had been in business, all the engineers you're going to bring in generally, if they're not from just straight out of college, are going to have some field experience or knowledge of their predecessor products, failure mechanisms or causes of failure. If not, that would be the fundamental thing I would have be researched is what caused failures in the past. Was it manufacturing? Did we have a lot of variability in our plant in Asia or whatever? Or did we have a component supplier that was not consistent and didn't have the manufacturing capability, you know, the CP or the SPC capability, the
CP, consistency,
CPK
capability.
Okay. You have some knowledge of those things. Or again, was it the customers were taking it out in the rain and it wasn't really meant to be waterproof? Okay. Those, you know, you've got to have an understanding of how it fails and how it has failed in the past. And I don't believe there's very many companies that are starting from absolute scratch, you know, of never having built a product before. They almost always have had some field knowledge.
There's a difference between, you know, how many failures you've had, this understanding, you know, what fails or how many things have failed. Mm-hmm. Now, designers often bring their experience of functionality. Right. Mm-hmm. It didn't turn on. And mm-hmm. then they jump to, now this is not true of all. I'm grossly generalizing, but they'll say, well, it's always the power supply fault, or it's always software's fault, or it's always, you know, and so some of that experience is masked by not knowing the root cause. And I think that's a hole in being able to triage those three things is where did it really come from? Now, in general, a good designer will sit down or a good team will sit down and look at it and go, you know, this has been tricky for us to manufacture. We have really tight tolerance to get our performance mm-hmm. here. So, mm-hmm. see, for me, that means it's a design problem. Why do you need those tolerances?
Right. You should make the design more tolerable to variation if you, you know, and I agree.
Right. So they may say, we know that this is a tough part to manufacture, and if it's wrong, it leads to problems, and vice versa. I always say, well, you need to fix the design. Which never seems to end as a discussion, right?
And if you we'll know, fix that in the next revision, you know that, Fred.
That's right. And
but we'll fix that in the next.
Or upgrade. Better yet, they'll say is we'll put it in the instructions so customers not use it that way. Like, right? Yeah, that'll work. But I mean, it's not a fair question. I think, Kirk, to you or to anybody in our audience, is well, which is the dominant one? Because it. What's your product, what's your technology, what's your manufacturing process, what's changed recently, what's not. But your advice is spot on is, well, what do you know? You know, start with what you know and then start filling in the blanks. If you don't have good root cause analysis, get it. If you don't have good capability of your manufacturing studies, go get it. I think you're blind otherwise.
You pointed out in our last podcast that I think it was Hewlett Packard or mm-hmm. one of them had a very good FA and very good knowledge of what maybe a manufacturing line's noise level would be as mm-hmm. far as producing rejects or having errors in the manufacturing line were kind of consistent.
There's a guy I sat across the hall from. He was more of a packaging engineer, you know, the box that you ship stuff in. And uh-huh. he could tell when FedEx changed their conveyor belts, that there was usually a drop somewhere where it dropped from one belt to another. He could tell when they changed that height because he was sending out so many censored packages through the systems to monitor uh-huh. the stresses of shipping uh-huh. a product. He uh-huh. he could detect changes in the shipping process, you know, without ever anybody having to tell him. He could measure it. And it was that kind of detail that they went through to understand the use environment, the shipping environment, and the design process.
Right. But the shipping environment, even though he knew maybe one UPS or that company, FedEx, others, US Mail.
He shipped it through them all. He
shipped it all through it, right? So see, he probably saw a wide distribution of how that. And it was true with other companies that I've worked with. They ship packages with heavily monitored or even just a fake package that they ship, and it's just basically a shipped instrumentation with recorders to show what the temperature, the shocks, variation were in an airplane and all the travel and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So they did get some very good information about the environmental shipping conditions. Now, that was just shipping, though, and that may have not been the harshest environment. And there are companies that are doing a very good real-time monitoring. I mean, Tesla, I understand from talking to one of their reliability people that they get a constant radio feedback of the condition of the car, its accelerometers, and temperatures of critical areas and things like that. Wow. They have a tremendous ability to huge amounts of data. Now, to see what's going on in the field with their cars because of this, you know, the very high connectivity of the car, I think, right. And it being all electric. So there are companies that are doing a better job of monitoring these conditions, but to be able to really do that on a smaller consumer product that's not $50,000 or something dollars is very a very costly thing, and you're really never going to cover the whole environmental profile. No. Or the population's environmental life cycles.
So you know, every now and then on software packages, on apps and stuff I have on my computer and phone and stuff, it'll pop up saying, you know, would you like to provide anonymous feedback to help us improve the product?
Right. Now, we get all that.
Yeah. You know, do you do that? Do you, because you know as well as I do that they need that kind of information. They're asking permission to send telemetry back to them.
Right. When the program crashes, they want to know. And that's, you know, I'm a little suspicious of that sometimes. I think it's just, I don't know that I kind of opt out a lot of times because I don't want my computer necessarily communicating to whoever. And they need to, you know, it's again, like you said, Microsoft just ships it to the field. That's how they find out whether it works.
You know, to be fair, they do an inordinate amount of testing. It's just an amazingly complex product. But that perception, especially with the early versions of Windows was, you know, good grief, you know, I have to reload the entire operating system every Tuesday. Because of the updates.
Right. And just as they get a stable system, they introduce a new system, a new operating system that's not stable. So, you know, and this is the thing. We're always technologically progressing and adding features and benefits and consolidating features and benefits into our phone or whatever. And so it gets the testing that is required to be able to have all those interactions and all the matrix of permutations of interactions is really very difficult in time.
Let's use just a generic product, right? And not consumer, industrial, or whatever, but just in general. We know that the design, the manufacturing process and its capabilities and how customers use it are all important.
Right.
Is any one of those stand out as is what's going to drive the reliability? It's going to make or break the reliability more so than the other ones.
I can't not it.
I give you a softball like that. It's always the design. it's always the design. You know.
Okay.
There are.
It's always the design.
It is because there's how many different auto manufacturers out there, right? And they all have the same access to how customers use their product. They all have the same constraints and problems everybody else does. Right. You know, their manufacturing processes are, they make decisions in their manufacturing processes, but they could spend more or less on it to make them more robust and consistent and so on. But the fundamental, if you got a perfectly built Yugo, right, I'm going to pick, I don't even know if they're in business anymore, little sedan, and you got an equivalent size feature set kind of car from BMW, one's going to last 10 times longer than the other one and have fewer repairs. They might be more expensive, but they're just not going to happen very often, right? And that's the design.
Right.
I argue that that's the design. And I think that's the same for phones, it's the same for computers, everything else.
Right, and I think there's a reasonable time that it should wear out. I just replaced an alternator in my Lexus in 1999 car. 1999, so it's 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And the
you need to go shopping more often, Kirk, I think.
I mean, but I didn't see that as an unreasonable failure. That was the alternator probably operated maybe 7-8 years. I don't even know if that was its second. Certainly, I don't think it was his first failing in 17 years. That would be an incredible lifetime to be designing for in a car, in an alternator, in a mechanical system. The rotors and the brushes and things will have wear and eventually wear out. So I think that you do have to limit, how much life you can put in something like a mechanical system. I don't think it's really hard for us to know what the life is in solid state electronics. It really is a difficult thing to be able to know what is going to be the dominant mechanism in that. But I agree that if it's, it all comes down to design for variability in the manufacturing process, design for variability in the end-use environment process.
That's right.
Or end-use environment. So in a way, I agree with you that if it comes down fundamentally to design and taking, the approach of HALT is to take a design and take it from its with the standard requirements, standard specifications of its what you want the customer to limit its use to, and then finding out if you have a weak link in it, and moving that weak link to a fundamental limit of technology to where you can't build it any better without exceptional cost or change in materials or change in manufacturing techniques that is really prohibitive and not industry standard. So, I'm just feeling that.
So you're throwing out here that it's the design if they get HALT feedback. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying it's the design if it fails in the field, either designed for manufacturability, the X is designed for testability, designed for all those things, all the design for. If those aren't met, and it's the things that are overlooked, and you just mentioned the first part of it, it's an overlooked issue. And so it's not known at the time. It's overlooked. But I guarantee, for me, in my experience, that it doesn't – you can't fool physics. You can't fool stress. You can't show, you can't – if it's weak, it'll fail. And if it's not –
I'm trying to think of the ignition key, where the ignition key would come out,
lock
up the car kind of thing.
Right. I wrote another article.
Yeah, you had a big article on that, but they had
the fish scale. Yeah, right, they found out the torque.
But it was one of those rare cases where they had a recall and they had a lot of documentation about what happened and what the root cause was. And, some of these things get locked up behind legal cases. We never hear about it again. But your article says if they would have done, they thought about testing this and checking the torque, right? Or the pull force on it. And then they didn't.
No, they found out from going to used car lot or the wrecked cars, these models, GM, the engineers in the field didn't have anything else to use. And they actually went and got a fish scale, fish weight scale that you would use
to measure the pull force of the key coming out.
To measure, right, the torque. And I say, what a simple idea. If you measure and you actually do physically measure, and this is where people have a really difficult time.
Now, I thought the article was about that it was a consideration in one of the documents. Oh, we got to make sure this is a spec. We should measure it. The key should stay in, kind of thing.
Well, all those things, right.
Those are specified, but it's also one of thousands of things to test, so it wasn't evaluated, it wasn't measured.
Well, yeah, right. It wasn't. And, of course, the fundamental problem was that the engineer made a change in the basically the plunger and spring mechanism that held the detent and did not change the part number, a fundamental violation of all of the engineering and manufacturing logic and rules, as that when you change a significant function, and whether he recognized that the spring force was too weak. And also another missing issue is that there wasn't anybody common in the company that knew that when the keys, the ignition switch turned back to the ACC or accessories only, it disabled the airbags. Mm-hmm. So there were two things that were just overlooked or not known and not connected. One was the weak, the force of the plunger and the spring. And then the second was the fact that when the key turned back, when the detent force was not enough and in a crash or in a violent event, going back to the ACC position, which it would do in a shock situation. So it might have been, you know, it could have been they measured the torque, but they also could have vibrated or shocked the column and that assembly, the whole steering column assembly, to where they would have seen the key go back into the ACC position, return mm-hmm, to mm-hmm, the ACC mm-hmm. position. So there have been a couple ways that, stress would have, if they'd stressed to limits or stressed to some empirical point, they would have been able to observe that. And I would have said that, you know, that would have been the destruct point or some operating limit point, you know, that would be defined by that test. So I that was kind of a mixture of lack of knowledge of this, of a total system, and an engineer changing a part and its function and its force without changing the part number. So that the real issue
would kick in the reviews and everything else then too. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it still comes down for me. It's a design. It's the design. You got to get it right. And you need information about manufacturing and end use and how they're going to use it in environment and so on. Let's chime our audience chime in here is, you know, you've obviously heard me talk about it's always the design creates the reliability.
Right.
And Kirk, you've been a good sport. You kind of agreed with me in general, I think, pretty much. There are plenty of other ways things can go wrong. And getting good feedback into the design process, I will agree with you that that's important. And there's better ways than others to do that. But for the audience, you know, what's your take on this? Where's your primary focus for improving the reliability performance of your product? Do you focus on reliability, the design, or the manufacturing, or the use conditions in understanding those? If you don't agree, that's fine. You know, Kirk and I don't always see eye to eye on a range of different things. I think at the end of the day, we're still trying to help you create a reliable, robust product that meets your customers' needs. What do you see in this? What's your rank ordering of where the focus should be? And if it's not design, well, then why? You know, we'd love to hear your feedback on that. So head over to reliability.fm. You can find the Speaking of Reliability show, and there's a handful of ways you can leave comments or send us an email, and we'd love to hear from you. So with that, Kirk, let's end on that we've actually agreed on something. It might be a novel change. Yeah,
we really agree on about I'd say a huge percentage, 90% of, you know, we have a few 10% points, and that's where I love talking to you about it and hearing and getting your side of the story sometimes, because we're both have different experiences in the field and our long career in reliability. So, you know, it's always useful to me. And again, I listen to your other podcasts with other leaders in the field to get a different perspective. So it's always helpful to have a very active discussion about all these kinds of things. And we hope this year the audience will write in. We've gotten some really good comments in the past, and we'll continue to look forward to having some additional topics or other angles that you might out there we haven't seen.
Yeah, I'm sure there are. Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. All right. Well, thanks so much, Kirk. Well, until next time.
Okay, Fred. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.